I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
It's football season now, but the real head knocking is happening in politics, where some of the players are going after each other without helmets. Meanwhile, the state's strict new abortion law ran into a block in federal court, and it's a blitz of candidates who want to succeed Johnny Isaacson in the U.S. Senate. We have got great seats for you in this edition of the Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare, joined again by Brian Robinson, a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is away this time, filling in former Atlanta City Council President Kathy Woolard. Hey to you both. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Good morning.
Okay, let's start at maybe a big picture look at Georgia in the middle of all of this frenzy over impeachment or not. New voter registration has spiked in Georgia in the last year or so. More than 350,000 new voters, and according to a Pew Center poll, most of them are under 30 or members of minority groups or both. But these are automatic registrations. They come when people get their driver's licenses. So we don't know if these folks are actually going to show up and vote.
Right.
Still, both of you have either run for office or, in Brian's case, run campaigns. Do even the experts have any idea what these folks who might make a difference in Georgia elections are actually like, or how to devise strategy for them?
Well, they're overwhelmingly Democrats. Republicans know that. And that's why you're seeing the Trump Organization in Georgia, the state party, the National Republican Senatorial Committee that's trying to help Senator Perdue and the next Republican senator. They are focusing on registration, going into areas where people are likely to be Republicans. And look, Republicans have a lot of ground to make up with the under 30s and even more ground to make up with minority voters. And I think you're going to see a lot more focus on that. One thing that you keep hearing in this Senate star search that we have going on right now is Kemp's desire to expand the tent, to expand the appeal of the party, and sort of looking beyond white guys. Not to say that it won't be a white guy, not to say that there aren't some great white guy candidates for that job who would do a great job, but I think he is going to very conscientiously look to see how can we make up some of that ground in the northern suburbs that we lost last year? How can we bring back some of these white women? I think the under 30s and minorities are a little further down the list because they're going to be harder to get. It's going to be a longer-term project.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a real long-term project. You can't undo the damage that's been done by Republican policies to these voters with just the change of the look of a candidate, right? You're going to have to change the stance of the candidate and address issues like income inequality, like school loans for these younger folks, like climate change, which is a huge issue for all of us. It's just not going to be enough to put, you know, a Jan Jones in place, but then have her being somebody who's championing the abortion bill. I think there's a lot of ground to be made up, but what we have to do on the Democratic side is make sure that these voters vote, because these are two groups of people, young people and people of color, who've been marginalized over the years or who have not been active voters, and it remains to be seen if they're going to show up.
I would disagree with Kathy on one thing. Now, younger voters, people under 30, under 32, whatever the cutoff is, have for time eternal not been dependable voters. That's not necessarily race-driven or ethnicity-driven. Young people just aren't as engaged in that. Now, minority voters in Georgia vote at the same level of their population in the state as white voters do.
So, Kathy, does this mean that Democrats and Republicans really have this canvas of voters and they have really no idea whether they're going to show up, how to get them to show up, and is your campaign going to be able to rely on them? It's tough for candidates and campaigns.
It's real tough. And, you know, polling isn't worth much anymore because it's hard to get people. People don't have landlines anymore. You know, catching people on cell phones is not something you're supposed to do.
So the telemarketers seem to be able to do it.
Yeah, they find a way, but they're not supposed to. And so that becomes difficult. But I do want to say, if we've got 350,000 new voters, most of whom are young and or people of color, and they're coming through automatic means, there's still something different happening because, you know, you would expect a spread that would reflect the universe of Georgians who are getting driver's license, for example. So I do think that there's something at play here that's worth looking at. And you know, we have some ideas about how to motivate different kind of categories of voters. But at the end of the day, what's happening in November next year is what's going to determine the intensity.
I want to come back to the Senate casting call in a moment, but there's one other kind of uncertainty for candidates, and that's the new impeachment developments. It seemed like the impeachment script for candidates might have been written early on. You could say, okay, this is going someplace or it's not. But now, after the infamous Ukraine phone call, positions shifted. In the 7th District, Carolyn Bordeaux, a Democrat who's one of that field, had to switch her position from saying, let's wait and see, to, okay, I'm in favor of at least an inquiry. And in those swing districts, the 6th and the 7th, does it put candidates in a really tough position? Because you could say something one day and new developments might put your position in a crowded primary field in a very different light.
Well, everybody's going to have some tap dancing and some explaining to do because this is, you know, there's a lot of politics involved here.
Yeah, no matter which party you're
exactly.
in.
Exactly. But I think, you know, if you are someone running for Congress like these folks are.
And as you have done.
And as I have done, you know, you're still also looking to the leadership in your party on what positions might be, as well as your own sense of what's going on in the district. So, you know, I think the position has been that impeachment was something that was a bit beyond reach. But this changes everything. And candidates should change their position when circumstances change, too.
And Brian, full disclosure, you are working with one of the candidates in the 7th District, Senator Renee Unterman. But bigger picture here. Can changing developments on impeachment paint a candidate, any candidate, into a corner in these swing districts?
That's always a danger. But let's remember, we are not in a general election phase right now. We are in a primary election
phase. Does that make it even more difficult, though? Because you have people who can outflank you on the right or the left.
It makes it easier. Because, look, if you are running in a Republican primary in the 6th or the 7th, which are highly educated, affluent districts, not necessarily your stereotypical Trump voter base, you have to defend the president. That is the only political incentive, is to say this is a witch hunt, to say this is fake news, to say they are just obsessed with bringing down the president and reversing the 2016 election. That is the easy political thing to do. And on the Democrat side, you mentioned Carolyn Bordeaux. Look at her incentives. In the last couple of months, a very serious contender, State Senator Zara Karinchik from the western side of Gwinnett County, has entered that race. Here's somebody who's going to have a built-in political base, just like Bordeaux does, and is seen as a smart, capable politician. So all of a sudden, she needs to do something that riles up the Democratic base. And the easiest thing to do is to be for impeachment. And I would say that if you are against impeachment in a Democratic primary today, you're basically saying, I don't want to win this primary.
Yeah, that's probably true. I think you're right, Brian. You know, this is a primary thing. By the time we get to November, if the president has been impeached, then, you know, getting out on that limb one way or the other is going to determine what goes on in your election.
Could you hurt yourself in a general election, though, by taking too extreme a position to win your primary, especially in those swing districts? Again, no matter which party you're in.
This is going to really determine how it turns up, right? Hindsight is 20/20 on this particular issue, I think.
We all know where the tribes stand on this, and I think there's an understanding that if you're in one tribe, you are for impeachment. If you're in the other tribe, you think impeachment is a witch hunt. That's that. And I think there's understanding on it. And I don't think it materially matters if he is actually impeached by House Democrats as far as the politics next year. And if it does matter, is it going to rally the Democrat base even more? No. No, they just got what they wanted. What it would do is energize the Republican base who feel under siege. And I think Republicans feeling under siege by our culture, by the media, by elites, is a lot of what drives what's happening in Republican politics in general today.
Let's now jump to the Senate casting call, because whoever gets picked by the governor could end up voting on impeachment or removal should the House Democrats go ahead and impeach the president and send the matter to the Senate. We've had a growing list of folks who have applied to the governor, including a Democrat, the son of Joe Lieberman. Does impeachment change the dynamic here? In other words, will there be a litmus test, Brian, for Governor Kemp now that things are even more riled up? Senator Perdue has weighed in and said, you know, we need to have somebody who's on our team.
Yeah. There is a litmus test. It's not ever going to be said that way, but I think what Senator Perdue said there will come to fruition. No one is going to be in the pool that Brian Kemp considers if that person has actively spoken out against Donald Trump in any way. If they've insulted him, if they've there's a lot of space between him and them on policy, you're just not going to be Brian Kemp's pick. I am sorry.
Yeah, well, I think you're right about that. And I think that is not going to accrue to the benefit of the Republicans this time next year. But we'll see. I think what's going to be interesting still plays out in Washington, where Mitch McConnell has to decide the position of the Senate in this. So it's one thing to think about, you know, the position of the president in this. But when you see Mike Pence polling better than Trump and the prospect that the American public is increasingly buying in to the level of concern over his behavior since he's been elected, but also particularly in the incident with Ukraine, I think McConnell's getting ready to have to make a judgment call, and we'll see how that goes. And that could affect this race in terms of who gets put into that position.
But you look at the people that the media are calling the top contenders. Your Doug Collins is your Jan Jones, as for example. Those are the two that have
Jan
emerged.
Jan Jones, the State House Speaker pro tem, Doug Collins, a sitting congressman who is on the Judiciary Committee and has been the chief defender of the president on that committee.
Bingo. That was going to be the point that I made. The president has retweeted Doug a couple of times in the last couple of weeks. So you got a staunch defender there. Jan Jones, in her application, talked about her support for the president's policies and her willingness and desire to be on the same ticket as President Trump and help get that ticket elected. So the politics are pretty easy calls here. And look, Kathy brought up the impeachment thing again. And we have an election in 13 months. That's why I think the Democrats are jumping the shark here. I don't think that they're winning over middle America with this, that the Ukraine development is the breaking point for President Trump. And you're not seeing that groundswell. Oh, this is it. We got to get him out now. It's not there. We have an election in 13 months.
Wait a minute. We are seeing the groundswell. And I, of course, preface this by saying that polling was worthless.
Right.
However.
Yeah. Here's a worthless polling bailer for you.
In macro, the polling is showing that there is a groundswell, that people really do understand this clearly. And it's not.
Well, the trend line is one thing. The numbers are another. In other words, yeah, I think everybody agrees there is a shift somewhat in concern over the president's behavior. But then where the tricky part comes for the polling is, does it reach critical mass? And I don't know if anybody understands.
Every day for 3 years, we've got, this is going to be the critical mass. This is where we reach critical mass. And then it never happens. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about how they got to bring down Brett Kavanaugh. Nobody's talking about that now. We move on super fast now.
We do. But this president doesn't move on. And that works to his disadvantage, I think. His behavior with the president of Finland was appalling. His use of a scatological term in a tweet was really, you know, it's insignificant in the scheme of things. But when you start thinking about the office of the president and the person who holds that position and the kinds of things he does, it was really beyond the pale in my mind.
Back to the decision for Governor Kemp then. Senator Perdue has said, not only do we need someone who's on our team, we also need somebody who will broaden the reach of the party and communicate the message effectively. Can the governor find a candidate who does all of those things?
There are numerous calculations, and there's no one person who brings everything. You know, Doug Collins is a great communicator. Mm-hmm. He's got name ID all over the state.
Because he's so closely associated with the president, does he broaden the reach to people who might be disenchanted?
Exactly. I mean, there's not a different profile for him than with David Perdue, perhaps, except for maybe he's not, you know, he's not like super wealthy. He is more of an average, everyday kind of guy who's served in the military. Jan Jones is an accomplished woman who can speak with authority on policy because she's done serious things as a legislator and as a member of the House. And she looks different than the rest of the delegation. And that means something, particularly with when we don't even have Karen Handel there anymore, even though she's back in the game in this
cycle. She's trying to win back the 6th district.
Back her seat. Yeah.
So, Kathy, if the governor were to select a woman, does that make it more difficult for the Democrats?
Perhaps. I couldn't tell you at this particular point. If I were the governor, I would be in no hurry to make that appointment. I would wait and see what emerges on the Democratic side to see who I think, you know, we'd be in a battle with after the primaries and see how the impeachment hearings play out. And I'd make my selection then. And I think more attention he gets as being sort of the power broker in this, you know, it all accrues to the better for him. So I don't know what he's going to do. Nobody knows what he's going to do. But I think hurrying with this doesn't help him. But I do hope that the Democrats hurry with the impeachment hearing so that we get to see where Johnny Isaacson would vote on this.
I'll say several things on how Kemp has handled this. One, his staff and he have held this extraordinarily close to the vest. Kudos to them. No leaks, no rumors that can be tied back to them, no real serious front runners that have emerged based on them saying things internally. So congratulations to all of those guys involved. And I think part of that reflects the fact that they don't have a front runner, that they are seriously considering this process that they put in place and looking at the candidates. There is some discussion going on externally right now, like will they just pick off the list and that's that? Will it be a round of interviews? Is there a possibility of somebody who's not on the list getting called in for an interview, which, as I said 2 weeks ago, would make a mockery of the process? They stick to the list, guys.
And I want to bring something up to follow up on something you said in our last podcast, Brian. You were saying that the open process, you know, submit a resume and everybody will get to see who submits a resume. You said that would scare off some potential people who might otherwise be near the top of the list. Any particular names that you've noticed in the last couple of weeks that you think might have been scared off?
I'm not going to answer the question of scared off. I will point out people who have not applied for whatever reason, maybe because they love their current jobs and love serving their constituents. Drew Ferguson would certainly be a top contender, very well respected, been a very effective congressman, has risen into leadership very quickly, and is known as being reasonable and easy to work with. Tom Graves is one of the more powerful Georgians in the House with a perch on the Appropriations Committee, someone who looks like Senator from Central Casting, someone who has money in the bank. And then you've got, of course, Attorney General Chris Carr, who's a dear friend of mine, I think just a genuine public servant who has approached every job that he's had for the state with the idea of serving people and basically has been above partisan politics in a lot of ways. He would be great. And he was Johnny Isaacson's chief of staff. So he's out of Isaacson world, so he would continue that legacy. But he has not thrown his name in the hat either. So I'm not saying that they're scared by the process. I'm just saying they're not in the process.
Meanwhile, as for the Democrats, in the race to challenge Republican Senator David Perdue, the other Senate race, Kathy, Sarah Riggs Amico got a key labor endorsement from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 613. She's collected over $700,000. And John Ossoff said he picked up $800,000 in the latest quarterly disclosures. So is this race still just waiting to percolate a little bit? Teresa Tomlinson is still networking, and Mayor Ted Terry of Clarkston is carving out the progressive turf. Is this race still way up in the air for everybody, or did Ossoff's entry change it?
I personally think it's still way up in the air for everybody. I think we've got some great candidates running in this race. I think it's going to be interesting to see how they distinguish themselves in the primary. Again, it's too early to tell what people are going to be using as those issues to distinguish themselves. And it may be, it may be just viability at the end of the day that is the distinguishing factor. But it's early, but I think it's a great field, and I think it's a fresh field, and I think people will be excited. What's missing in the field, and we'll see if it makes up in the other seat, is that we don't have a leading African-American candidate in that race or
picked out
in the other race.
Huge problem. The Democratic primary is as wide as a Bavarian hunting lodge, as wide as a Northern Canadian hockey team, as wide as a Irish
as a Republican
dance
slate
group
in Georgia.
Yeah, which we get hit on by you guys all the time. And look, I mean, you do not have one minority candidate emerging in either one of these races. And that's a huge problem for Democrats. I believe we talked about it on the last podcast. They've got to have a charismatic, capable, able to fundraise, acceptable minority candidate on the Democratic side to generate turnout amongst the Democratic base. I think African Americans will be offended if there's not a significant African American who emerges as a leader here. They are a majority of the Democratic primary electorate in this state. But now, that said, I'm not blasting people who have thrown their name in the hat because they're white. That's offensive too. John Ossoff and Mr. Lieberman and Mrs. Tomlinson, et cetera, Riggs Amico, they have every right to run. And I credit them for throwing their name in the hat. But where are your Keisha Lance Bottoms and your Michael Thurmans? I'm not saying them specifically. People of their caliber.
Kathy, is that a problem for the Democrats in getting their most reliable voters to turn out in a critical election year next year?
Well, I think it will. But I think, again, which is not to say that we won't see somebody in that primary emerge. But I think what's interesting, as much as we've seen the governor hold back on his appointment, you haven't seen a field shape up for the obvious open seat. It's a grueling seat to be a part of because of the special election and then turn around with a re-election right after that. But, I think that folks are being very, very careful. There's a lot of conversation going on. People are being vetted. I think Georgia is so in play for 2020. I think the potential for Stacey Abrams to be a vice presidential candidate is still wide open and on the table. With two Senate seats, it makes sense to do, because if Georgia goes Democrat and the rest of the states stay the same, we win. I mean, Georgia is it. It is the obvious linchpin with these two Senate races. So people are going to be very careful about how these things shape up.
So you think we will eventually see, for one of these races, an African-American Democrat jump in, a high-visibility African-American Democrat jump in?
I do.
I think you have to. If it doesn't happen, you're going to have Chuck Schumer fly down to Atlanta and go door to door saying, hey, Mr. and Ms. Smith, will you please run for U.S. Senate? It is mandatory.
Give us
them
a little credit, Brian.
Okay. Oh, do phones? You think you'll call around, not do door to door?
No. Give us a little credit on the lineup.
Democrats are building a bench. Interesting, one thing that's happened in recent years as Democrats have regained some seats in the legislature is they've won back some majority white areas. And so some of the new blood in the Democratic Party is actually younger and whiter than what you've seen over the last 20 years. So that's an interesting development. So you got to think you're going to go find an African-American candidate from the old guard, because I don't know of any that are emerging in the political circles that are going to be obvious candidates for the U.S. Senate.
That's because you're not watching closely. They're out there.
I'm not gonna
mention any names because I don't want to put anybody on the spot. But there's some great candidates, African American candidates out there. In particular, we've got Latinx candidates out there. We've got a strong bench of people that are coming up that are interested. And I'm excited about this race coming up.
Derrick Johnson. He's not here. Maybe he should run.
Maybe so.
We'll pass your message along. And we will be back with more of The Political Breakfast in just a moment. Much more to get to. Stay right here.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/freechecking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And we are back with the Political Breakfast. Happy to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare, joined this time by Republican strategist Brian Robinson and filling in for Theron Johnson this time, former Atlanta City Council President Kathy Woolard. One of the major issues of the last few weeks, of course, the ruling by a federal judge issuing an injunction against the state in the lawsuit brought by the American Civil Liberties Union against Georgia's new abortion law. Now, the injunction doesn't rule on the law itself. It simply blocks it from going into effect until January 1st, while the broader case inches forward in the courts. Kathy Woolard, the new law, House Bill 481, bans abortions in Georgia after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. And the judge said the Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld the 1973 Roe versus Wade decision, and this law goes well beyond the parameters set by that. But is this ruling a surprise in any way to either side, do you think, or is it just putting Georgia in line to perhaps be the determining case in an eventual challenge to Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court?
Well, I am not a legal strategist. I'm a political strategist, and so I couldn't deign to say, but it comes as a great relief because I don't think that Georgia women need to be punished on behalf of somebody else's political strategy and or legal strategy about this law. And so, I think it's important that this happened. We'll continue with the legal wranglings about it. I think it's an awful law. Georgia is number one in maternal death in the country. Women all over this state have very limited access to reproductive health care via insurance or even the presence of medical providers. And this is just, one more thing that makes safe and planned family planning, something that women in Georgia can expect as a routine thing.
Brian, there's also the personhood provision, mm-hmm. which says an embryo can be claimed as a dependent on the parent's taxes as soon as a heartbeat can be detected. And Judge Jones said that language is really tough to understand or even enforce, and that could be problematic as it moves through the courts. But can you separate the viability, the 6-week ban, and the personhood provision from each other? Or in trying to do both things, did lawmakers set themselves up for having Georgia's law perhaps tossed because it's too vague in the personhood part?
The personhood is part of the legal strategy, and the strategy is to get a case, whether it's Georgia's or mm-hmm. another state's, to the Supreme Court. Now, why now? Well, because you've got a conservative tilt to the court now that has grown under the Trump administration, and pro-life forces in this country and in this state think that with the advance of technology where we can see for our very own eyes that little human form there on that screen when you go in there to the doctor's office, that we know more about the development of these tiny humans than we did in 1973 or even in the 1990s when there was the Casey versus Planned Parenthood case that also was an important precedent here.
But I want to pick up on this with Kathy as well. Roe set viability as the standard, and the state is saying as soon as you can detect a heartbeat, whether or not that embryo could survive on its own at that point, that's when abortions should stop. So
I think pro-life forces are more than happy to say, let's look at that standard and revisit it based on modern technology and what we know today. They're happy to have that fight.
I think this is extremist, and I think it's not good public policy. And all of that was laid out during the discussion in the legislative session. But when you allow someone to claim on their taxes that the mere status of being pregnant causes personhood, it is going to be a nightmare for the state to figure out. The financial liability of that is going to be very, very difficult. But that's because this is not something that's about public policy. This is something that is about politics. This is something about the status of women and reproductive health care in this country. And I think that I am sorry and really ashamed that Georgia is at the forefront of this discussion.
Politically, though, and Kathy, I'll start with you, does it make a difference in terms of voter turnout in the coming election, or is it pretty much people know what they think about abortion one way or the other, and it's not going to make a whole lot of difference when it comes to a campaign or a candidate?
Well, I think as you see the Republicans losing the hold on moderate women, that this will not aggregate to the benefit of Republicans in the coming election. It is not the issue, I think, that anyone wants to lead with, because I'd much rather be talking about the issue of maternal death in this state, which has been covered up for years. And we could spend an episode talking about how that's happened. But I think if it accrues to anybody's benefit, it's going to be women. And it's going to be women in Georgia. And it goes to the math of why Georgia is going to be so important in the national elections.
You know, Senate Majority Leader Mike Dugan in this week's AJC about what happens now with the abortion law, he was like, voters will vote on numerous issues, not just one. Now, I agree with him, and I agree with Kathy, that with moderate white women, this is a net negative politically for Republicans. But one issue that Democrats don't want to talk about is that the extreme nature of their presidential candidates and the pull toward the left of the Democratic Party is also going to hurt them with moderate white women who don't want their private health care insurance taken away for a Medicare for All plan, who think that decriminalizing the border is a ridiculously dumb idea, who think that we should give health care insurance to illegal immigrants. They have their own problems with moderate white women, and let's go have a scrum and fight it out.
And so we will.
Speaking of fighting, that continues over the budget cuts ordered by Governor Brian Kemp. The 4% cuts have just taken effect as of October 1st. The governor wants another 6% cut from the budgets of state agencies for next year. Brian, this at a time when the governor and the president are also saying, hey, we've got a great economic success going here. But the governor's budget economist also telling lawmakers there's a 50-50 chance of a recession. There's a real mixed message and kind of conflict of message coming here that the governor hasn't quite figured out how to balance yet.
Well, I'll just jump in here. What concerns me about this is anytime that you're making just blanket cuts without discussing what your priorities are, I just have to think that this is some sort of political stunt or something, because what are this governor's priorities in terms of spending, in terms of programming? Where are we going? And to just kind of keep coming back to the department saying, just, you know, slash 10% off the top of your budget, it's okay, but it's not very sophisticated budgeting, and it certainly doesn't indicate any policy priorities that I can figure out.
I remember distinctly, Dennis, when we did a live show in Marietta during the transition, and probably was in December of last year, I said, look, Brian Kemp's going to have a different set of cards than Nathan Deal did. Deal benefited from 8 years of economic expansion. Kemp more than likely will face a recession that is not his fault. It's not of his doing. It's going to be a national, perhaps even global phenomenon, and he's going to have to lead through it. And he's going to have a message that is effective. And I'll also say that this timing may work out well for him. It would be better for him to lose some popularity points in 2020 and not be doing great politically then. Trump takes those hits, not Kemp. And then the economy could be growing and rebounding in 2022, which would be a great timing for him.
But
on that same thing, because we're 50-50, as Kathy has said, because Democrats do have opportunities, I think that Trump losing this year is better for Kemp winning in 2022, because, you know, Trump winning would mobilize Democrats and energize them so much. Now, I'm not wishing for that, but just the bare facts here, that's what's best for Kemp.
So we'll forward that message to the governor and see if he picks up on it.
Yeah, I don't think you go here saying that. Okay. So that's my job. I have to do it because he can't say that.
But in the short term, at least, is part of the state's revenue malaise, if you will, for the moment, caused in part by the president's trade war, which directly affects the Port of Savannah. It affects Georgia agriculture and a bunch of other industries that the state relies on for revenue.
Yeah, that and the abortion law, because you're certainly seeing the film industry taking a walk here. But I think, yes, and I will say, I think, just to get back to the elections, because everything is about the elections, is Georgia farmers are going to be taking a hard look at Democrats. you know, I think they felt let down by Sonny Perdue. The fact that we've got a pecan crop that mostly used to go to China and now sitting on the trees or sitting on the ground wondering where it's going to be made up from is going to impact those people tremendously as you know, the time it took to get any aid at all flowing into the state after the hurricane a couple of years ago. So I tell you, if I were a Democratic candidate statewide or otherwise, I'd be spending a little time in Southwest Georgia talking up some farmers.
The Democrats have their own problems with that demographic. They are not an acceptable alternative to the agriculture community. And one thing, you know, when the New York Times, Washington Post go out to Wisconsin and interview dairy farmers, they're looking for the person that Kathy's talking about. I was with Trump, and he is destroying my farm, and now, blah, blah, blah. That's not what you hear. You hear, yeah, times are tough. The trade war is hurting us, but something had to be done. Somebody had to stand up to the Chinese. They were breaking the rules. They were playing unfairly. And finally, somebody's going to be out there and fight. And we're going to have short-term pain, long-term gain. That's what I'm hearing from farmers. I'm not denying that they're hurting. They are. But Trump says they're hurting. Purdue says they're hurting. But they're looking at the long term here, which is hard to pull off in politics, but for now it's holding.
But back to the budget cuts for a moment. This is coming at a time when the state is getting bad news about its nationwide rankings in terms of maternal mortality and HIV infection risk, just to name a few. You've got the GBI looking at cuts to its lab techs at a time when it's just now starting to get rape kits, the backlog of rape kits processed. So this is a really tough case for the governor to make, even, Brian, to some Republicans, I would imagine.
Budget cuts on the state level are always difficult because there's this idea out there, and I think Republicans have furthered this idea to their own detriment when these things happen, that there's all this fat and waste in the state budget, and there's not. When you look at where the state money goes, most of it goes to
education and prisons.
Prisons, health care, safety and law enforcement and the judicial system. I mean, this idea that we're just like handing out checks to people sitting on their couch is not accurate. And so—
Phew, glad to hear you say that.
No, I mean, look, I work for Governor Deal. I mean, we made the budget for 8 years. So, I mean, how can I sit here and say it's a reckless budget? That would be putting myself in a bad position.
So
it'd be putting Kemp in a bad position because he wrote this year's budget.
Dennis, you just did a political consultant's dream in weaving together maternal health care, HIV, rape kits. Those are three strong talking points for why women should be voting for candidates that are interested in those issues and have policy plans for addressing them. That's going to be the kind of conversation we're going to be having next year. And when you start looking at those budgets, this goes back to policy priorities. I mean, we've been number one in maternal death for years. And part of that's because we didn't expand Medicaid. Part of it is, you know, for a whole host of other reasons that we could go into. And, you know, and we have a task force in this state that can't publicly reveal any of their findings by law.
If you talk to Democrats, every issue in the budget is a funding priority. So what would they cut? They would cut nothing. And so the difference—
We'll soon see when Democrats move back in. But
what y'all are going to do is raise taxes.
Well, here's
and
the
question. And that's going to be the divide between these parties.
But the state—
Kemp is cutting spending and not raising taxes because that's what Republicans stand for.
But the state just cut taxes, cut income taxes. Was that a smart move at that time when the state already has quite a low top rate on income taxes?
We don't have a quite low top rate compared to our neighbors regionally. Our neighbor to the south has no income tax. Our neighbor to the north has no income tax. Our neighbors to the left and right have one about where ours is now. So no, I reject that. This is about being competitive. And let's remember, this also is on the wings of the Trump tax cut, which was causing a windfall into state government because of how it changed calculations. And so this was returning some of that money, some of that windfall back to taxpayers, which, whether you like it or not, is what Republicans stand for, and they are delivering on their promises.
You know, we need to stop comparing ourselves to other southern states. For years, we used to take, you know, solace in the fact that, you know, other southern states were doing worse than us in various metrics. That's not the case anymore. We're doing worse than the other southern states on a whole host of metrics: education, healthcare, that kind of thing. And so I think we need to stop kind of comparing ourselves to the bottom of the barrel and start thinking about Georgia being a leader in this country and being innovative and using the businesses that we attract in a way that benefits all of our citizens. There's ways that we can come out of it looking good, but right now we don't.
Speaking of the budget, there may be some spending coming up on a couple of things that have surfaced in the last few weeks because of excellent reporting. And I'm tying two things together that may seem a little unrelated at first. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution's investigation of problems in state senior care facilities and the ongoing problems at the ethylene oxide-emitting sterilization plants in Cobb and Newton counties, among other places. These have two things in common. One, they came to light because of excellent reporting, the ethylene oxide, because of Georgia Health News and WebMD, and as I mentioned, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on nursing homes. The other thing is, a lot of these problems came to light because of the reliance that the state has in both industries on self-reporting. The state agencies rely on the industries themselves to tell them about what's going on. Brian, I'll start with you. Can we expect to see in the legislature pushes for more funding for at least a little more oversight in areas, not just nursing homes and medical sterilization, but areas where self-reporting can be problematic?
I don't think you're going to see a big push to increase spending on anything in this next coming session because we are in a budget crunch and, you know, Kemp has prioritized teacher salaries and giving them raises. That's a big bite of the budget, worthwhile and a good endeavor. But you can make an argument for every line item in the state budget because it has been written by Republicans since 2003. It's a conservative budget, and the money that we spend is on stuff that's worthwhile for our constituents. We all wish there was more crime scene investigators to speed up rape kit evidence gathering. We all wish that there were more DFACS workers with smaller caseloads. We all wish there were more EPD employees to make sure that there's not cancer-causing agents in the air around plants like Styrogenics. But we can't have everything, and that is what the budget process is about. And the idea that if we don't spend $1 million, I mean, unreasonable amounts.
Oh, okay. Stop. we can just spend this until forever. But again, going back to what I just said, which was if you're going to do 10% budget cuts across the board, at least exhibit some sense of priorities. And you've just named a bunch of really great priorities. Expecting people to self-regulate, expecting people to turn themselves in is like expecting those 13 legislators who got summoned by the Ethics Commission to raise their hands and say, I didn't file my reports, please fine me. That's not going to happen. So I think it does speak that we do need regulatory oversight over critical functions. And thank God that where we do have good media functioning for us to look into things that are complex and that require a lot of effort, that exists, because those people who live around that Sterogenics plant have been seriously harmed by the lack of oversight. And that cannot continue in this state.
Another issue that will have political ramifications. Georgia Power wants a rate increase. It's a $2.2 billion rate increase request. The average bill would go up in phases over 3 years to an increase of about $200 a year for the average ratepayer. This at a time when Georgia Power is hitting profits that at times go above the targeted range set by the PSC. Brian, is this one that has political ramifications for members of the PSC? Some of them, including Tim Echols, not to single him out, but among others, have been very visible, raising their political profile. Does that make them more of a target, too?
You know, Tim, of course, has put his name in the hat for the U.S.
For the U.S. Senate,
as well. This is a political position. So every decision, every position taken by the PSC is a decision that could have political implications.
So it comes back to the old question of, okay, you've got coal ash pits, for instance, that need cleaning up. You've got Plant Vogtle going on, which is a whole different thing. The ratepayers and the shareholders. Is it time for the shareholders to bear more of that cost? Isn't that the big political question here?
Well, I think it is. And I think, you know, you've seen nationwide and maybe even globally, but nationwide in particular, that CEOs are coming forward now and saying, you know, shareholder primacy it's really distorting the market. And I think it's distorting rates in this state for people to have to pay. A $200 a year increase in electrical rates is really outrageous. I think ratepayers in this state are tired of paying for Plant Vogtle, don't want to pay for the cleanup. And let shareholders still extract extraordinary value from this state. So I think it's going to be a difficult case to make.
You know, this is a capital-intensive business, and part of how you raise capital is keeping shareholders happy and keeping their money in the pot. So it's a different structure than many other businesses that you deal with.
But it's also a regulated utility that has a monopoly, or almost a monopoly.
And what Georgia Power is going to say is we have not had a rate increase in 6 years. And so, of course, when you wait 6 years, it's going to be bigger than it would be if you had done it incrementally, which that seems fair to me. We do know we're having more hurricanes, more major storms that are disrupting infrastructure. That is raising their costs. And they're having to invest in resiliency for these additional storms. So it's always tough to ask for a rate increase. But
you can't continue to be a major polluter and waste money, and then come back and say you're planning for resiliency.
I don't think anybody
wastes. And I'm not anti-Georgia Power by any stretch of the imagination, but they have not told a good story for the past 6 years.
I don't think they're wasting money. I think that Plant Vogtle in our nation's history is going to be seen as a very important event.
That will be the subject for a podcast in about 25 years, and we'll know
the
answer
right.
by then.
when Georgia's producing energy with no greenhouse gases, everybody will be like, oh, thank God we were so smart.
Finally, a couple of milestones. Opera giant Jesse Norman, an Augusta, Georgia native, passed away at the age of 74. And Kathy, she was supposed to be back in her hometown on October 11th for the honorary naming of a street for her. She endowed the Jesse Norman School of the Arts there in Augusta. She was involved in reaching out and making the arts accessible to kids, especially economically disadvantaged kids in her hometown. And she sang for the world on top of all that.
And she sang for the world, and she's our homegrown talent. I mean, she was not an old woman when she died, and so it's far too early. My grandfather was a great opera fan, and took me to operas when I wasn't appreciating it, but I did grow as I got older to appreciating her and her contributions, and we're really going to miss her because she left way too soon.
Absolutely. Just somebody who's known around the world and deeply respected, and just part of a smorgasbord, a menagerie of tremendous Georgia talent that has impacted the world.
Meanwhile, Jimmy Carter celebrated his 95th birthday. I'll start with the Republican over here, Brian. Whatever one feels about President Carter as a president, as a Georgian, he has again brought the world to this state and has made a difference in ways that go well beyond what he did as president.
You know, my history with the Carters is a little different than most because, you know, one of the Carters ran against my balls in 2014 for
his
governor.
His grandson, Jason Carter, was the Democratic nominee who ran against Governor Deal in his reelection bid.
And, you know, he did what a grandfather should do. He said some pretty mean things about my balls, which that's all in politics, you know. After that, however, Mrs. Deal ended up doing a lot of work with Roslyn and with Jimmy on the Memories of the Mansion book that she created. So That's one great thing about both of them. They're able to put that behind them and work together on a project that's of meaning to the people of this state. In the history of Georgia, there will be few that will rise to the stature of Jimmy Carter. Obviously, president puts you in elite category. Yet, I am so glad to see that he's still in good health, that he's still out there serving this community, that he's still out there being a voice for compassion and for Christianity and for giving back.
And setting a standard for ethical behavior and really demonstrating what it means to be a selfless public servant. And happy birthday, President Carter.
Yeah, happy birthday.
We're also very proud of you.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Filling in for Democratic strategist Theron Johnson this time, former Atlanta City Council President Kathy Woolard. Thanks so much to you both. This has been fun.
Go Braves and go Dogs.
Thank you. Yep.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Kathy Woolard is at Kathy Woolard. That's Kathy with a C, by the way. Brian is at Lord Tinsdale, and I'm at Denisohayer. And if you like this show, subscribe. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.